This episode of our This Week in XR podcast is sponsored by Zapper. Zapper is one of the world's leading XR companies. Over the past 12 years, they've won numerous awards for memorable campaigns. They've democratized AR by making tools and SDKs that anyone can use. And they created Zapbox, the world's most affordable mixed reality headset. Most recently, Zapper worked with Unilever to create an enhanced QR code called Accessible QR, which enables packaged goods to speak to the blind and partially sighted. If you're thinking XR, give the team at Zapper a call or visit zapper.com to see how they can help you on your XR journey. Good morning, everybody. I'm Charlie Fink with Ted Shilowitz and Roni Abovitz for This Week in XR. It is April 5th, 2024. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. I apologize for my King of the Frogs voice. I'm a little under the weather this week, but I will weather through with you all.
I got the daycare croup for my granddaughter, so I am suffering from the same thing.
Time of year. I think I'm okay, so I'm just
That's good.
So one of us is okay. Kind of a slow news week, but we have a great guest. Maureen Fan, founder of Baobab Studios, former Zynga exec, who has produced some of the most notable VR stories of the past, I think, almost 10 years. I think they were producing content for Cardboard back in the day.
That's right. I know Maureen and her team very, very well. In fact, when I was at Fox, we made an initial early investment in that company at the first wave of, you know, what VR entertainment might look like. And it was very interesting. She's lovely. She's really interesting. Her partner, Eric, is really interesting, comes from traditional animation. And they make really cool stuff.
Eric Darnell.
I did meet them. They made Crow.
That's right.
Right. They made Crow.
Yeah. I remember them bringing that to Magic Leap. I thought that was awesome. Crow was really, really great.
So, and I want Crow supposed to have multiple parts. So we'll find out more about that.
That's right. It's supposed to have multiple parts. You're right.
So let's start with something really controversial and a little bit scary. ChatGPT voice cloning.
I was going to say, does it relate to AI?
Well, yes. Does it relate to AI or does it relate to AI? It's called the voice engine. And it can mimic your voice perfectly from a 15-second sample.
So we've been using versions of this for a little bit of time now in the professional entertainment world to do dubbing and subtitles, right? Where we can now take an actor's native voice and change it into any language. So that's a controversial in and of itself because you are displacing voiceover actors in various languages to do that. This takes it to the next level where you just drop in, 10 or 15 seconds of a sample, and then you can type or just speak into anything and it can change it into any voice, right? It's sort of terrifying.
Can I give you guys our Friday philosophical piece? Because Charlie, you brought this up, but this is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I mean, literally, you can do good things with this, right? There's a main, like Ted's talking about a good use case, and actors can like license their voice and generate revenue, and that's very cool. And you know, if you have some control over it and it's used in cool purposes, it's amazing. But I keep bringing up this idea of the asymmetry. Like there's so many bad things people are going to use with it. It's not that the technology is inherently bad. We're doing bad things with it as people. So how many bad things, like for political disinformation and someone calling you up, pretending to be a relative or pretending to be, you know, God knows what, you know, or a government official saying something, it wasn't really them, phone hacking people who are senior citizens, like, there's so many bad use cases that how do you control it? That's the problem.
You think there's a parallel like in our younger youth days, companies like Monsanto and DuPont that came out saying, we're going to sort of revolutionize agriculture. We're going to make everything better. We're going to make food cheaper. And at the end of the day, their aims were not as pure and honest and worthwhile as they started out, or at least they were tempted to, because their science sort of put this kind of continual loop of what technology did to the farming industry with GMOs and all these things. And ultimately they were not great agents. They were bad agents. Do you think there's a parallel to that?
Charlie? Well,
the unintended consequences here are obvious. I put a joke in the column today at Schwab, my voice is my password, because if you ever call for voice assistance,
Right.
they make you make a voice print, so to speak. Well, I suppose that voice print, they must know about this, because that voice print has to be out the window. If OpenAI can do this, others can do it. Right. Yeah. So the thing is, OpenAI says it's too dangerous to release to the public, but it's testing it with certain private companies, which releasing it? I don't quite get it. Why would they be testing it if they're not planning to release it? If it's dangerous, why would you test it?
Well, Charlie, think about this. You know, the Native Americans, I think certain tribes were worried about having their photographs taken in the late 1800s because it would capture their spirit.
Yes.
They were right.
They were right.
Think about this. Once you are captured digitally, voice, image, pattern of behavior, it's like some kind of mirror world thing has got you. Right. Yeah. And we're in that era now. The thing that we're talking about we're in that era where once you are captured, this evil wizard can manipulate you. So I think it has to do with the intention.
The intention
of the people using, are they Jedis or are they Sith? And unfortunately, I think the overwhelming amount of people leading AI companies and being funded right now are absolute Siths disguised as like, oh, we're nice, but most of them are not.
Well, what's terrifying as we hear sit, you know, mid 2024 is that there's almost no way to tell if what we're doing right now is real, that we're really doing this, or is this synthesized?
I don't know if you're actually there, Charlie. You know, guys could be like,
I know you look the exact same every week.
It's a strange sort of concept.
Ted is always wearing a black t-shirt.
Especially when I wear, this is actually dark blue today. But, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Except we did get together at South By and we got together, you know, in LA. So, yeah.
But, you know, you think about the implications of this, that no one would know if this was really us or an AI version of us today. Now extrapolate that to the year 2035, right? And what it's going to be and what it's going to look like.
What does that say about the digital world, though? Like, the lack of trust is going to be a huge limiting factor.
Yeah. I will bring up something that I think is really important, and I think maybe once a month we should mention it on the podcast for all our listeners. If you, for all your family members, don't have what we call a safe phrase or a safe word, a safe series of words, you need to have one.
The air gap password.
Yes. You need to have a set of words that is totally air gapped, that has never been on the internet, that only you and your family know. It can be kind of an inside joke or an inside like piece of words. It shouldn't just be one word. It should be a phrase that if someone calls you and says, we've kidnapped your kids or your grandpa, or whatever's going on, or we've seized your bank accounts, and you say, okay, what's the phrase? So what do you mean? What's the
Ed, you just gave me a great idea for like a Netflix series.
Oh,
right?
God.
So imagine like someone like Ted is captured by pirates in the Caribbean, and you're calling us up and you forget that the phrase is Dear Tim. And you're like, no, it's really me. Well, he didn't say Dear Tim. And then you're like, and now you're stuck on this Caribbean island.
Captured off of David Copperfield's yacht.
Yes, that is the Black Mirror episode that you forget your air gap passcode. It's kind of like, when people lose their Bitcoin, their private key, and they forget the 20 words, and the PC ends up in a landfill and they've lost $1 million. It's a real thing. It's not theoretical. It happens. So
Bitcraft raised a new $275 million fund to invest in interactive games and things like InWorld, in which they are heavily invested. These guys have pretty good taste. They go after seed and Series A, so early stage startups. So the game industry, despite its doldrums, still has people betting big money on them. They continue to be larger than the movie business and the music business, which gives you an idea of how much people are playing games today, particularly mobile games. So you get onto the subway and you see everybody looking at their phone. I think 3/4 of them are playing games. So pretty interesting. And that fund now has $1 billion under management, by the way. So there is another company announced today, most interesting because of its pedigree. The guy who started it, it's called Higgsfield, is named Alex Masharov. He sold his company AI Factory to Snap for $166 million in 2020, and I guess was their head of AI for the past 3 years, and now has struck out on his own again with this company called Higgsfield. But they want to do Sora, but for the lower end audience, right? If Sora is going to be thousands of dollars an hour for media companies to use, this is going to be, tens of dollars to use right. for social, maybe you'll have a subscription, or for a big generation, you'll pay, $15 in credits, but they're doing it as an app. It's not, PC or Mac based. You do it on your smartphone, and they're targeting that very, very large universe of content creators.
Yeah, that seems to be what Meta's approach is too with their Llama engine, is to kind of bring it downstream and make it an ad supported model and support all the compute costs with advertising, and make it a little more, it seemed like they stumbled a little bit, but they last year at the Oculus conference, whatever they called it, the Kinect conference, they announced all these kind of like personalities of celebrities that would be AI, and I think it kind of fell on deaf ears. But clearly, there's a lot of folks working on this kind of stuff. And what's interesting from a trending standpoint is it seems like a lot of these AI specialists or these AI kind of founding mentality folks that ended up going to work with big, well-funded companies are feeling a little distressed about that and striking out on their own, feeling like they can make it big on their own and start their own thing. So it's an interesting little sort of time frame of a lot of these folks that are highly coveted and wanted by the Googles, Apples, Metas of the world going, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to do it on my own, which is kind of an interesting sort of telling sign, I think.
I'm going to throw out a really interesting problem that's what's going on is developing. The Sora type companies that are living on everyone else's IP and acting as if there's an eminent domain right to everyone's creations. They somehow have some eminent domain right to it, or fair use, which ignores all copyrights, everything. They're going to make stuff. Now that stuff that they make is going to be fed also into AI engines as a second derivative. So now if I'm an artist or did work, it's now lost in like some giant blender. Mm-hmm. And I think what the problem here is that the courts are not gonna make any sense. So if this thing continues, we're going to have like oceans of garbage being spewed out by kind of like low level AIs using second and third derivative recasts. But the work that someone makes, if it doesn't have protection anymore, what does that mean to whole sectors of the economy, to film, to music, to patents, to technology? If all IP is disregarded, right? The attitude you're seeing in some of the interviews are, I have a right to anything you made. It just seems like this eminent domain right. So I think all of these companies, their business model is, I'm going to use algorithms on top of stuff that people made over the last century. It's just like, it's a very, very much like Napster. So I'm wondering, where is the government and what's going to happen here?
Yeah, well,
I think this is a real serious issue.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I don't have a lot of information on this, but maybe Charlie or Roni, you have more. I think it was 200 music artists all banded together to effectively protest what was happening on the music front with AI and their voice likeness and human likeness. And then in, let's see, where was Elvis from? Memphis, Tennessee. Is it in the state of Tennessee? I think they passed a law called the Elvis Law that you could look up that is protecting the artist and the estate of the artist from this type of IP theft.
One last thing on this, but there's Suno. Have you guys played with Suno AI?
No.
Suno is a music startup that I think is the actual closest AI thing to Napster we have right now. It is completely unapologetically sitting on gigantic masses of music, and you type things in and it just makes music for you in like 10 seconds. Like you write a blues song or it writes lyrics, and it's basically built on a whole bunch of music that it seems incredibly unlikely they have any copyrights to from any of the labels or any of the artists.
Yikes.
And right Yikes. Now you pay them. There's a free version. There's like a $29 a month version. So they're going to be spewing out, and they are already, tens of thousands of songs, probably per hour than per day. So as a user, it's very interesting. But if you remove the right for them to take other people's copyrights, now this company has to start all over again, like Spotify, and get legitimate use. And I think there's a real problem here, but they're just running, right? So Suno is generating thousands of songs. It's worth playing with because it's already, it's one of those things you're like, wait, when did that happen? It's out there and there's users and they're making music with it. And it shows the remarkable power of AI. But if you ask the question, where did they get the music that creates this engine? It's all the musicians that they've scarfed up like a whale eating up everything. And my guarantee is like none of those musicians have given a right.
Yeah. So right. Here's an article that here's the headline from Ars Technica, which is a good source for this stuff. Billie Eilish, Pearl Jam, 200 artists say AI poses existential threat to their livelihoods. Artists say AI will set in motion a race to the bottom that will degrade the value of our work. So this is Pearl Jam, Nicki Minaj, Billie Eilish, Stevie Wonder, Elvis Costello, the estate of Frank Sinatra, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're, you know, they're basically trying to put some sort of stake in the sand. The problem is these sands are shifting really fast, to your point, Roni. And once the layer on top of the layer of who was the original artist, we get to that level, it's impossible to unwind this. So
Think about this.
Admirable
what
that they're
Suno
trying,
is offering. We're just going to pick on them today. $24 a month, you get 10,000 credits to create 2,000 songs. For $24, if you can make 2,000 new songs, you have effectively set fire to musicians because things like Suno are going to get better. And I'm not against AI being a tool for musicians. I'm not against AI at all. But the idea that you can just simply take other people's work and now charge for it and take all that work and say it's worthless and you can just have all you can eat on someone else's, you know, someone else's back, that's a huge problem. Because if you removed all the music that they claim to have rights to, that people have copyrights to, I bet you nobody opted in. There is nothing here. You have to start all over again. Oop, we have our guest.
Yes. Hi, Maureen. Thank you for coming. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Maureen.
I think you know Ted. And
yes.
And I believe you and Roni have met down at his Florida headquarters.
I think your team came to Magic Leap where we saw Raven.
Crow.
Yes.
Crow.
Oh, Crow. Sorry, not Crow.
Okay.
Sorry, Crow.
It's okay. Sometimes in Native American cultures, it's Raven instead. But yes. Yeah,
oh, okay.
So,
nice to see you, Maureen. As always.
Good to see you, Ted. I miss you. I'm going to be down soon.
I know. Good. Well, come visit. We're here.
I'll be at the Gainsbeet conference.
Oh, you're going to be at Gainsbeet. Okay, well, we'll see you there. You probably heard I'm leaving Paramount, so I'm striking out and going to do stuff.
What? So. Wow, okay. Congratulations.
That's an odd congratulations, but yeah. Lots of opportunities about. So cool. I look forward to catching.
So, Maureen, we were just talking. Your studio has been so productive from the earliest days of VR. I think Crow may be the most recent, but gosh, it's a long list of credits. But we were just commenting, since you had such a regular cadence of releases, what's next? Is it part two of Crow, or where are you? Are you producing content as quickly as you used to for VR?
Yeah, well, our goal was right from the beginning to become a company that rivaled Disney. So to be honest, it was never just to be focused on just one area or one medium. The goal is always to create IP that transcended mediums and could go across different mediums. So we have a VR division, we have a film TV division, we have a gaming division, and we have a publishing division. So a lot of the IP that we birthed in VR is now becoming TV shows and films. So we have a first look deal with Fox Disney for all of our IP to become feature films. We've announced two series with Disney Plus to become normal series. That's both Intercats and Witchverse. And Witchverse is based off of Baba Yaga, the VR piece that we created with Oculus, with Jennifer Hudson, Daisy Ridley, Kate Winslet, and Glenn Close. And then Intercats is a graphic novel series. And then for the game side, we just released a VR game. So it's a fishing game based off of our Invasion, the first project that we ever did that was with Pico and now with Oculus. And that's been great. It has like almost 5 stars, is it 4.7, I think. So we've been really pleased with that one. So we continue to do VR, as well as on the game side, we have several Roblox games. with over 21 million views. Oh yes, this is Chloe the Bunny, which Ted gave me great advice for.
This is right, a little piece of Maureen's and I shared history that it happens to sit in my little museum that I sit in. This is the bunny from Invasion. Excuse me. We thought it was so adorable.
For those listening, it's a stuffed bunny.
It's a stuffed bunny. It's not a real bunny. And we thought it was so adorable that she should make a toy, and she went and made a toy. And I have one.
It's all to actually, Ted, you're also responsible for one of the best connections that we have. So when I went down to visit Ted and the Tribeca folk, both Jenna and also Paula Weinstein, rest in peace, were visiting, and he's like, why don't you stick around for longer and meet up with them? And that's how Invasion or Asteroids actually premiered at Tribeca Film Festival, at which point Jane Rosenthal became my mentor and now advisor to our studio. And Jane is who helped me get in contact with Oprah, and Oprah came on for Crow the Legend. So that was one of the, so thank you, Ted, for helping me. Yeah, anyways. Oh, sorry. Okay, so that's the gauges. So we have Roblox games, several of them, 21 million plays, and then also VR, and then also, what else was I saying? Fortnite, and then also on the publishing side, we have graphic novels, manga, and multi-series book series with Penguin Random House and Macmillan. So the point is, but what I love about VR is, you know, it's a place where I get to experiment. It's not so risk-averse compared to all these industries with all these gates decide if you get greenlit or not, right? It's a great place to experiment with IP. And then if it happens to do really well, then I'm able to bring it to other mediums. Actually, Momoguro, which is one of our latest IP. Do you know Nico and Martine? They did Battlescar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Nico and Martine came to us, and they had this idea of Momoguro. And for VR specifically, it's like Pokemon meets Voltron is what our fans say. So instead of inorganic creatures coming together to make a giant Voltron, organic creatures like little Pokemon glom together to make a giant Momo beast. That's what we call it. So they came to us and said, let's do a VR thing together. And we ended up taking that into Roblox games. And we just announced a TV deal for it as well. So VR has been amazing, and XR with people like meeting new creative people and creating IP together.
So Maureen, here's a question for you, because, you know, one of the things that I think you and I have been always frustrated about with VR, with the type of work that you've been doing, is you've always yearned for the type of visual experience in a headset that would rival a movie screen or a television screen, and we really weren't able to get there. I would say the Quest 3 gets pretty damn close, but not quite to that visual fidelity and smoothness that we want. But now here comes the Apple device. Now, given there's a lot of flaws in the Apple device, and if you watch our panel from South by Southwest, you'll learn all about them in massive sort of discussion points. But remove all the flaws and take all the positives of that device, the visual experience you get from that device is truly stunning and amazing, and I'm sure you've used it. Could you have any thoughts about the forms of entertainment that you're doing, these kind of hybridized forms?
Yeah.
I feel like it's a good place for that work.
I love the Apple Vision Pro, because one of the reasons this is perfect for interactive narrative, which is what we focus on. So much of the consoles right now, sorry, they're not consoles. So much of the VR, XR headsets very clearly are being marketed as purely game consoles. And so it's not surprising that the people who tend to purchase are gamers. It doesn't mean there's not other use cases. I really love what Chris Milk is doing and showing that it's not just for what you consider the nerd gamer, is what they call it. But the Apple Vision Pro specifically says that they're not just a game machine. So like in terms of gatekeepers, right, the distributors, I'm excited that they're marketing it as not just that, but also just visually fidelity wise. I remember we had this experience we wanted to create, Eric did, in AR at the time. He just felt that it wasn't ready yet. We were thinking about even just doing it with the phone, right? And he had this idea of being able to, like, a monkey comes out and wants to, like, the vines come down and the ability to, like, traverse the space. And we just realized quickly that it wasn't possible yet. But
you should tell the listeners about Eric, about his pedigree, and Like he's a big part of your success, that DNA
Oh,
core
yeah.
of.
He's amazing. So Eric Darnell, he's my chief creative officer. He's co-founder. He wrote and directed all the Madagascar films and also Ants, which was DreamWorks' first ever full-length animated CG film. So he's a visionary. He loves XR because for him, it felt like the early days of CG. He was an intern at DreamWorks as animator, and then Katzenberg just recognized his talent and said, "You are now directing Ants." So he's amazing, but he's a fourth highest grossing box office animation writer director of all time. So, but he loves XR because he says it feels like the early days when no one knows what they're doing and just engineers and artists are coming together to try to figure it out. And he's like, I want to be part of creating a new medium. So Eric, right from the beginning, was creating these experiences, but he was all excited about AR for the same reasons. And now finally there's a headset that can allow you to do that and immerse you in those experiences. I'm also really excited about the social experiences, specifically that headset allows. I love avatars because I like to live in a fantasy world. That's why we create entertainment. At the same time, I think experiences that bring people closer together is just better for humanity overall. And the like when you're there, you actually feel like that other person that you're interacting with is actually there, because it's you don't only have to do the avatar, you can actually see their true human form. You feel like you're actually there. I think that's really powerful, and I'm excited to take advantage of that. That being said, I think it's far away. I just want to be clear.
Well, it's always far away, right? This is our problem.
Far away.
But yeah. Speaking of avatars, a little nugget that I heard yesterday, and I think that you can start doing it now, is that the second gen of the engineering on the Apple avatars, the first ones were super creepy and interesting. Apparently they have a gen 2 now that we should all go back into our Apple Vision Pros and remake our avatars because it's better now, or so they say. So we'll try it today and see.
It's finally doing the face tracking where your avatar not only looks like you, but it's tracking your expressions and also your position. So even if you're just kind of a head and shoulders, you know, people still look kind of ghost-like, but it adds a whole nother dimension to the presence of the avatar, and people are talking about it because it's much, much more powerful.
Yeah, good. It's one, what Apple does really well is they keep refining, right? When they see a soft spot, they will refine. So that's good. Exciting.
Yeah, I think the head and shoulders thing is going to start to bother people after the oh, wow. After the oh, wow that you get from it, I think it may start to be like it was on Meta Horizons, where it was so neat, and then all of a sudden people were like, hey, you have no legs. It never was an issue in alt space, but I think as more and more people come into it, they have a demand for, you know, they're less willing to accept. I mean, think, for example, in the Vision Pro, they can get by with janky avatars for quite a while based on who's using it today. But when they really get into the phase where now they're going to start ramping it up to tens of millions of people, you know, no one would accept that kind of placeholder. But as you said, they are evolving it. Yeah, that was a piece of news we didn't get to. Maureen, we always start the show with 10 minutes or 15 minutes of the news, but we get so hung up on AI and its implications, particularly for creativity. We were talking specifically about its ability to create music. And
Charlie, I think that dovetails into a really interesting area for us to ask to talk to Maureen about, and I'm sure Roni will have some thoughts on this too, because Roni's working in the creative realm with AI. You know, Katzenberg came out, I guess, about a year ago now, and said in the fairly near future, animation costs will be cut by 90%. Everybody was up in arms, freaked out about it. Over time, you know, as much as I hate to sort of agree with any of that logic, as I see what Sora is doing, as I see what, you know, Runway is doing and all these other companies are doing, still in the very early sort of gestational stages, I tend to agree more than disagree. I think the cost, the raw cost of the animation creation, removing the creative talent, removing the creative need for really good story and really good narrative, the technical side of building animation for a company like Baobab, all the way to a company like Disney and Pixar and Marvel and anywhere in between, is going to be dramatically lowered. Do you have any thoughts, opinions, worries about that?
I'm not worried because I am the business person. So therefore, for me, like that's the annoying part about animation is it takes 5 years to make an animated film and like hundreds of people. That's a lot of money, which is why you tend to animation is a big bet when you're going to create a
A
Pixar movie.
pix
You spend
yeah,
a lot of
Pixar, a
money.
Pixar movie can cost $1.5 million a minute.
Yeah, you're talking about, yeah, a
Yeah.
couple $100 million
Average
investment and then the
200
marketing on top
million.
of it.
But
It's
yeah.
got to make $1 billion or else it's a loss, right? So you think there's a new
Exactly.
age of creativity coming? A
I
new.
do. That being said, I don't think one could say, you could look on the positive side and say, okay, well, by decreasing the cost, that means you can have so much more. You can create even more experiences. But I think humans can only consume so much. Store so many stories that I think you see with all the streaming, right? So much choice. They actually showed that choice makes humans less happy
Yeah.
because you feel stressed out. And they also said when YouTube came out, they said, oh my gosh, this proves it levels the playing field. Anybody now, anyone finds, yes, but what it actually ended up doing is making, the long tail in the head, it actually made the head even more pronounced. Because people are so stressed, like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to look at. So they rely on the curators to say, these are the most important things. And then everyone flocks to just the blockbusters and no one watches the rest of the stuff. So even though it decreases, it doesn't mean that it's good for creative people. That's what I say.
Marine, question for
Yeah.
you on that. I definitely have line of sight to, I think animation, really, really high quality, let's say Pixar level, is going to drop to tens of dollars per minute. It sounds crazy, but I could see it happening, and I may be working on that. If that happened,
I love how Rhodey just teases the stuff like I maybe
I
know, but
know,
I'm saying
but
if that
otherwise, it's top
happened,
secret.
right?
no, but like, if you think about that cost. You just said something really interesting about that, the head, the torso, and the tail. Do you think that's going to be true in animation, like in YouTube and other things, that there's will be a pronounced head
I do.
when a kid in, let's say a kid in a garage with a with an imagination and $1,000 could make Toy Story at the
Yes,
same
I
level
think
of
there
quality as
is.
Pixar? What's going to make the difference
The
for the
difference is they
people at
may
the head?
choose the head might be that kid rather than Pixar.
Right,
That's the
right.
difference. I'm
Okay.
excited about it because people like Hollywood used to not green light shows about people, non-white dudes. And they're like, oh, it's risky. And then if you look at YouTube in terms of what people, some of the top influencers are not just the, it's like, see, data proves it. So it means that you don't have all these gatekeepers. That being said, I will say, the reason why Pixar movies cost so much isn't necessarily because of production. It's because you iterate the crap out of it. Every producer ever at Pixar is like, heck, just figure out the story already so that we could just make it. And the problem is the director, the story people keep on changing the story as they go to the very end. So the film doesn't actually get made to the end. And it's that costly cycle that makes their film so good. So
So, Maureen.
it will decrease the cost, like all the tech that we create and the tech that we help to make you iterate faster. But I still think that iteration, nothing gets rid of that part. The more you iterate on something, the higher your quality bar, it's still going to bias towards those who are willing to iterate.
Maureen, question for you, because I 100% agree, but is it now, let's say, look what your studio, you might have. You, a creative director, some writers. Is it a room of 10 people who iterate 500 times in 3 months? Whereas, let's say, at a
Absolutely.
Pixar,
So
I can
it's a
only
lot
iterate 30
cheaper.
times in 4 years.
Yes, but that is why I'm not as interested. My studio is not as interested in just doing the same thing for cheaper using AI to cut costs. I'm more interested in figuring out how AI can help me create new experiences for humanity and where you can actually interact with the characters and all that is much more interesting to me than figuring out how to I use it to be cheaper than everybody else, because that's what TV industry is all about. How cheaply can I make it? Same with YouTube. How quickly and cheaply can I make it? That's not exciting. It is exciting to my business brain, but I'd rather go into figuring out the medium or the experience that's gonna crush it. Like, so
Well,
everyone's chasing me.
Here's kind of the wacky sort of either ultra utopian or ultra dystopian question about that, right? When we talk about iteration, which I think we're all in agreement. I mean, Charlie was a Disney executive. He knows all about it from the inside out, right? About that human factor of reworking and massaging that material until you really get its true emotional core, like coming out, you know, oozing out of it in such a strong way. And that tended to be a very human thing, right? Now, the utopian or probably dystopian version is if you start with what you think is a good idea, and then you start to ask your AI prompts, make it more emotional, make it more connective, make it more like Pixar, make me cry. And it will continue to drive all that iteration that took 4 years and $40 million of human labor. And you can do that with robotics, with machines, with AI. Is that an exciting thing for your business brain, a terrifying thing for your emotional brain? And this is, I think, the biggest problem with AI is it's Jekyll and Hyde at the same time. That's the biggest issue with what we live
I'm
in.
excited about it, but it's similar with social networks like TikTok. I worry about the impact to humanity in the long term. The way I see it is AI is not going to create the Spider-Verse one. So everyone is now sick of the typical Disney Pixar thing, right? They're like, I want something new. And then Spider-Verse comes and like, whoa, it's so different. If AI is all based off of past stuff, it's just going to make it so that once Spider-Verse is a hit, now everyone wants to copy that. So it's going to help the business copy it super fast, but it's going to make the cycle of us humans getting bored with it
Much,
faster.
much
So the
faster.
cycles of needing something new and being even more ADD is got so in that sense, I'm frightened for humanity because I already feel like the cycles are a bit fast. I'm a little sad when there's a cultural moment like Barbie comes out that it doesn't last for longer. It's like, okay, what's the next thing? It's like a hedonistic drug cycle that we have bad. So I'm both sad and excited because it like for a person who gets bored easily like me, part of me is excited about how the generations are gonna time generation is shorter and we're gonna keep on advancing even faster, but I'm also frightened of that.
Well, I think about, the generations of our kids. Like my kids are already adults, but you have a little one running around, right? So you get to see through that lens of how they're absorbing content, the kind of content they want. And I think that's fascinating to have someone young in your household at this age watching what Creatively will do with these tools and these levels of compute is kind of an interesting thing. I mean,
Ted, can I
Ronnie and
ask?
Charlie and I have adult kids, so we're,
I want to ask Maureen a question. Maureen, you brought up the idea of like the gatekeepers. It seems like one really interesting advantage not talked enough about are the folks who don't get the green light for their $400 million movie, and people of all races, genders, ages, et cetera. Feels like that's going to be interesting. Not the long tail who are making not good stuff, but there's really talented people who might wait 10 years for their chance to make one animated film and they don't even get that. So it feels like that's going to be maybe a golden age. That's like that top layer. I mean, do you see that happening or?
I do. I think it's what YouTube has done. It's what TikTok has done. Though I think it's slightly sad that most kids, their dreams and aspirations are to become influencers, like all of them. I don't, that terrifies me. But yes, I think that there's an opportunity. Things like YouTube, things like Roblox. I call Roblox the YouTube of gaming because it's like barriers of entry are so low. It means that anybody can do it. That being said, if you also look at YouTube, Roblox is what I was talking about earlier, where the trends are just so fast, it's whatever's memey at the moment. I do worry a little bit about creating long-lasting value. But yes, I absolutely think the low barriers of entry means that anybody could go compete against crazy expensive, gatekeeper type people.
One more question for you, and then I'll give back to Ted and Charlie. You hinted at like going beyond what we know, going beyond films. We talked a little bit about that at South by Southwest a couple of weeks back. What, in your view, what is that beyond movie experience? What's happening? What do you call that?
I don't have a name for it, but our studio has always believed in, well, the mission statement, right, is to inspire the world to dream, bring out your sense of wonder, make you matter. And that last sentence, make you matter, is what we believe differentiates us. We want you, the audience member, to matter to those characters, to form relationships with those characters. So you care that much about your that story, you want to know what happens. They have a relationship with you for the rest of their lives. So you can imagine the experiences that we want to create and are creating are blends between movies and games. Games are superior business model. I'm just going to say it. You dollars per minute, you code it once, you replay it a bajillion times. A great business model. That being said, a lot of times when I was VP of games at Zynga, so Farmville franchise was my franchise. If I was going to spend another dollar towards developing that character more or doing more animation versus put that dollar towards creating more features that people can play for hours and hours on end, I'm going to choose a feature. So I think oftentimes games do not focus as much on the stories and characters. And I think that's a missed opportunity. Like Candy Crush movie. I'm more loyal. I would maybe play it, but I'm more loyal to the game mechanic, the match three, more so than the wrapper around it necessarily. So I think there's an opportunity if you could do great characters and story and merge that with great gameplay, you have the most superior medium of all time. And so that is what we at Baobab care about and have been working on since the beginning. But it's hard because game people and film people do not understand each other at all. And the cultures are complete opposites. So that's where we do feel we have advantage because for the last 8 years of our existence, yay, we're still alive. It's been about forcing the two sides to merge with each other and coming up with production processes, pre-pro and development to make sure that those two work seamlessly together rather than are separate and fighting.
So you mentioned earlier Fortnite. And that you were doing some work for Fortnite Creative. You also mentioned the social aspects of VR. So, of course, Fortnite is the metaverse, perhaps the main outpost in the metaverse. And, of course, people are building, and supposedly over half the time that their users spend in Fortnite is actually spent in Fortnite Creative, not in the Battle Royale. So I'm very interested in what a creative studio would be doing there. As we know, Disney and Lego are going to have a large presence in Fortnite or in a metaverse like Fortnite. So I'm very interested in your approach to that and what you guys are building. What can you tell us?
We do what we do in every single medium, which is create IP. That's all it is, like great stories and great characters. The thing we're really excited about with the Disney announcement and Lego and new announcements that have been coming out is before you could only do guns, basically. And if you don't have guns, your experience is probably not going to be as successful, which is not that aligned with my family-friendly content that we create. So, but we're very excited about our having great relationships with Epic. They've supported us from the beginning. Our first experience, Invasion, was built in, and they give us great marketing, and we also did the Epic Mega Grant and all that stuff. So we're fortunate enough to have this relationship, but we're excited about where the platform is going to be able to allow you to create IP and experiences that are less only men and shooting focused. Right. But yeah, what we are focused on is creating a family-friendly IP that is social and can be played by millions of people that are in our target age demographic.
Do you still use the, I guess what I'd call the film festival circuit to premiere things and show things off, or is that kind of in the rearview mirror a little bit at this point? Like, have you kind of evolved past that in terms of the benefit, the cost versus benefit sort of equation of that?
I think festivals were especially important to VR given that there were no eyeballs in VR. Mm-hmm. So you need a lot of marketing. So getting a lot of press or accolades at a festival does not translate to lots of eyeballs. But it was helpful in terms of establishing Baobab as a brand name, as high quality, which really helped us in all the other industries. And so anyone doing XR, I would still highly recommend doing that. Right now, I'm always going to do the festivals. Well, there's a difference between always in every industry, even like traditional film, between quality accolades, awards, and commercial success. And so I want both because I want to be like Pixar, where I'm creating high quality, critically acclaimed content, but I also want eyeballs. And the thing that was frustrating in the early days of VR, and even now, probably XR in general, is I can make critically acclaimed stuff, but who cares? Like, as a business person, as a CEO, I need to make sure my company survives and has money, right? So I'm still doing it because I care about, at least on the marketing side, right, to be the brand recognition. But I'm really, really focused. It's my job and fiduciary duty as a CEO to make sure business-wise I have lots of eyeballs and money coming into the studio.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with that. Yeah.
But I will always be loyal to those who helped us start our studio, right? The Tribeca, the Sundances, yeah. Like they helped me. And so anytime for anything, I will do anything for them. Because they
absolutely. I'm the exact same. Yeah. Like you helped us get on the map. It's important for us to give back.
Yeah,
and yeah, absolutely.
You did an amazing production at Tribeca. I think it was in 2018 or 2019 with Matthias Kjellborg called Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah.
And I don't see that many things that make me go, wow, even then. But of course, and it was one of those things, of course, like it was a one-time only, location-based, technology heavy, giant servers running, super expensive experience that really put you literally in the movie. And there were, you know, humans doing live performance mixed with all sorts of, you know, graphic animation magic. And it was 5 minutes long. It ends right when the beans start growing, and then the experience ends. And because of course, if they had kept going, only three people would have ever gone through the whole experience. They had to make it short enough so that they could have some modest throughput within the context of a festival where very few people can actually get to see any given experience. And it was done, and I guess here's my point, and it was done not for any obvious commercial purpose. There was no way to duplicate it. If you did it commercially in a venue someplace, you'd have to charge $250 for the 5 minute experience. So, but I thought it was a breakthrough in so much as it showed the potential that the medium had. Yeah. So I just wanted to applaud you for doing that. It had no obvious commercial purpose. It must have cost so much money. I'm not even going to ask how much it cost.
It wasn't. Okay, the story there is I want to create something for Tribeca. That's really the reason why I did it, is because I want to make sure that I have something new and impressive for Jane. That's what it's about. It was loyalty to Jane. Want to make sure I have something. We had 3 months. I think it was 2 or 3 months before that. And Kane, we've always wanted to work with Matthias because thought he was a creative genius. And then I said, Kane, go make something awesome. And literally said, Kane, you only have this much money. And it's so much cheaper than anything else we have ever made. Studio.
Oh my gosh.
It's so little. I like, Kane, go make happen. Go. And I said, I don't want to hear about it. And Kane came back with the pros. And I'm like, yes, at this time I was getting married, I was buying a new house, all sorts of things. I'm like, don't talk to me. Just go make it. So Jonathan Flesher and Kane literally, because they were in France, I created a production company in France, hired contractors, built the entire experience, figured out how to break, because I'm like, you only have this much money, brought it over to like way less than half a million, way less. Because way less. Anyway,
wow.
I was like, okay, go figure out how to make this all happen. And Jonathan Flesher, who's now, I think, head of BD at Reddit. So he and Kane just mastermind the whole thing, figure out how to ship everything. They kept on calling me like, it's expensive. Like I said, no more money. So they figured out how to do it, tax credits, everything, and brought it and just made it all happen. So my team is amazing. But that's the fun thing about being at a startup, right? It's like,
it's
bring in people that I trust and say, go, I trust you, go make it happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, Charlie, that you mentioned that, because it definitely brought back some very strong memories of this period of time. Like, you know, with any kind of industry like this, there are these sort of renaissance moments, and those kinds of years, this is what, pre-COVID, so 5-6 years ago, sort of, was one of those renaissance moments where the technology was coming together, the headsets were getting better, there was this push for this stuff, and that Jack and the Beanstalk experience is probably one of the closest things I can recall that gets you to the sense of what we refer to as the holodeck moment, right?
Yes.
Where it's not just visual, it's tactile. You're touching things, you're connecting to things. Our friends at The Void did that. And these things had a moment and they're kind of softening, and I'm hoping that they come back again in an even more powerful
Sandbox
way.
is doing really well.
Yeah.
Especially in Asia. So that's what people should be doing who wanted to just go to Asia, because there's demand for sure there.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said.
At Sandbox VR.
Oh, Sandbox
really
VR,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing
that's
really
the place
well.
We keep trying to get to, Ted.
Yes, I know.
Marine, I have a question for you.
One in LA.
Yeah.
Marine, question for you. Like, all of the work you've done in the early days, it feels like now that you've got like companies like Apple have come in, they're putting tens of billions of dollars, Meta spending $15 billion a year. If we go to like 2030 and you're Apple Vision 4, and now maybe lots of people have these systems, are you going to reissue all the work you've done? Because I feel like a lot of people in XR have made things that would be massive hits if there were like 500 million headsets out there, but they're only seen by a handful of people. And now what you're seeing with the Vision Pro is like deja vu for me. Things that we did 10 years ago being popped up and people going, oh, it's as if it existed for the first time. I'm wondering, like, do you have a plan to bring your media again and again? Because finally, when there's going to be real scale, all the stuff you've done has a chance to be seen by, as if you were starting on day one again. Does that make sense? Because it feels like your work is probably going to be relevant to hundreds of millions of people, maybe 5, 6, 7 years from now.
That's the awesome thing about animation, right? It doesn't age as much. It's just like how many frames per second. But because I had all my engineers were like Pixar and DreamWorks people, they all had this like crazy, like, what? I'm going to force this game engine to do what it is I want and mix our Pixar quality. So it's all high res, whatever. So our stuff does port and travel really well, even to things like the dome, right? We did Namu, which was shortlisted for an Oscar, with Cosm and domes. And it was like domes worldwide and just looks super awesome. And then we actually went to project some of our VR's old like Invasion on it, and it looks amazing. So absolutely, that being said, I will not do it on my own dime. And so every single time we ported it to Quest or whatever, the platform has always approached us and given us the necessary funds in order to do the porting, because it's always complicated. But absolutely. And as a business person, I'm like, hell yeah. I spent those dollars and I get to keep on.
Yeah, your library will probably gain in value because the scale of like theaters, like the headsets, is going to grow significantly.
Yeah.
Maureen, this has been a great conversation. It was very kind of you to come onto the show and share your experiences. I have 50 more questions for you. So perhaps we'll have you back again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Always fun to see you, Maureen. Makes me very happy. Puts a big smile on my face.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That's our show this week, and we will be back with you again next Friday. Have a great weekend.